Welcome, and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. I'm joined by my co-host, Gary Scanlon, a principal in the same group. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Kristen. I'm excited for this one, as always, but especially so this time.
The United States has notably not adopted Pillar 2, nor is it likely that they'll do so in the near future. But that doesn't mean that U.S. companies won't be subject to Pillar 2 legislation implemented by other countries. This has inspired multiple legislative and executive proposals in the U.S. to retaliate against countries that adopt Pillar 2 rules. On parallel tracks, however, the current administration has expressed a willingness to negotiate with the inclusive framework of the OECD on a path forward to protect U.S. multinationals against additional taxation as a result of the Pillar 2 regime. In today's episode, we will explore the concessions that the administration are asking for in relation to Pillar 2 and the potential international response. For our discussion today, we're joined by a friend of the podcast, Michael Plougin, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice, and recently the Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Tax Affairs at the Treasury Department. Welcome back to the podcast, Michael.
Thanks, Kristen. Great to be back.
It's great to have you back, Michael. This one should be right down your alley, given your work at Treasury and in particular with respect to Pillar 2. The Trump administration, unlike the Biden administration and Republicans in Congress, have expressed outright hostility to the idea that U.S. companies could be subject to Pillar 2, particularly by reason of the under-tax profits rule, or UTPR. Indeed, at the outset of his second term, President Trump, in a presidential memorandum, rejected the, quote, OECD global tax deal, end quote, disavowing any previous U.S. commitments related to it and declaring the deal to have no force or effect in the U.S. unless enacted by Congress. Additionally, the Trump administration has requested that Treasury investigate the possibility of invoking Section 891 as a retaliation for Pillar 2, as well as digital service taxes, or DSTs. Section 891 allows the president to double the rate of tax on citizens and corporations of countries that levy, quote, discriminatory or extraterritorial taxes on U.S. citizens or corporations. Members of Congress have contributed with two legislative proposals that would retaliate against DSTs in Pillar 2. In particular, Chairman Smith's proposal would penalize foreign countries for adopting UTPRs or DSTs by incrementally increasing the rate of tax on FDAP income and ECI by 5% each year for 4 years. Representative Estes's proposal, sometimes called the Super Beat, would modify provisions of the BEAT regime for any foreign-parented group that operates in a country that has adopted UTPR by increasing the BEAT rate to 12.5%, eliminating all the prerequisites for being in scope of the BEAT, i.e. the gross receipts test and 3% base erosion percentage threshold, treating 50% of COGS as a base erosion tax benefit, and eliminating the exceptions for services cost method payments and payments subject to withholding tax. One or both of these proposals are likely to end up in the House's tax bill, a draft of which we expect to be released imminently, for which we expect to have a podcast episode on in the next month or so. So while the Trump administration has shown its willingness to retaliate against the international community for taxes it perceives as discriminatory or extraterritorial, the administration has also demonstrated a willingness to negotiate with it. Indeed, in April, Treasury sent four representatives to the Inclusive Framework Plenary in South Africa to negotiate a path forward for the U.S. and the OECD on Pillar 2. So before we dive into the path forward on Pillar 2, let's talk about why U.S. multinationals are particularly concerned about Pillar 2. I don't think many people would view the U.S. as a tax haven. The U.S. corporate federal tax rate is 21%. That's even before factoring in state taxes. That's well above the 15% minimum tax rate for Pillar 2. So, Michael, why should a U.S. company have to even care about the Pillar 2 regime?
I think you're right. I don't think many people view the U.S. as a tax haven, but Pillar 2 is not based on the headline rate. It's based on an effective tax rate based on your accounting income. And so the treatment of various tax incentives is really crucial to how Pillar 2 applies. And what's driving this concern about Pillar 2 with respect to U.S. profits in particular is that business credits like the R&D credit are not refundable. And that means that they are not treated favorably in the Pillar 2 regime and could expose U.S. entities to top-up tax. As you mentioned, the biggest tension point for the U.S. is the application of the UTPR to U.S. profits of U.S. multinationals. But also the IIR could apply to claw back the benefit of business tax credits like the R&D credit of U.S. subsidiaries of foreign multinationals. Now, there's a UTPR safe harbor that currently protects U.S. profits of U.S. parented multinationals, but it expires at the end of this year. And in addition, the UTPR safe harbor doesn't protect the U.S. profits of foreign parented MNEs that, again, could be subject to the IIR. So, of course, the UTPR safe harbor doesn't protect them. And the IIR already this year potentially applies to their U.S. profits. On top of that, GILTI is not treated like an IIR. So there could still be IIRs and UTPRs of other countries that are applied against the foreign subsidiaries of U.S. multinationals.
Thanks, Michael. That's helpful. So what exactly are the points that the U.S. raised at the Inclusive Framework Plenary? What are they seeking to achieve?
What we've heard from Treasury is that they really need to protect the tax sovereignty of the U.S., while also recognizing the tax sovereignty of other countries. They want a solution that says that Pillar 2 top-up taxes don't apply to U.S. multinationals or U.S. constituent entities of foreign multinationals. And the way I understand that is that for U.S. parented groups, IIRs and UTPRs would not apply to either their U.S. entities or their foreign subsidiaries. And for foreign parented groups, no IIR or UTPR would apply to their U.S. entities. So what does that mean? First, it means that the UTPR would be turned off with respect to U.S. profits. And that would have to be broader than the current UTPR safe harbor that I just talked about, which only protects the U.S. profits of U.S. parented multinationals. Second, it would mean turning off the IIR on U.S. profits of foreign multinationals so that the foreign jurisdiction doesn't claw back, tax back the benefit of things like the R&D credit in the U.S. They don't want the R&D credit to be subsidizing foreign tax authorities. Third, it would mean treating GILTI as an equivalent to an IIR, turning off IIRs and UTPRs with respect to the foreign subs of U.S. multinationals. I think it's important to note that doesn't necessarily mean treating GILTI as an IIR, because there are all kinds of complicated rules about IIRs and how they stack in the rule order. And in addition, there are a lot of reporting and compliance burdens under Pillar 2. And frankly, U.S. businesses don't want to be subject to those. So Treasury wants U.S. multinationals not to have to file, for example, the Globe Information Return, the GIR, or be subject to any of the compliance requirements of Pillar 2. Essentially, my take on what they're saying is Pillar 2 and the U.S. system are just different systems, and they can coexist entirely separately, which is different than saying that GILTI is an IIR or is otherwise part of the Pillar 2 system. And I guess lastly, I understand that they are also concerned about the QDMTT rule order. And under the existing rule order, QDMTTs would come before cross-border taxes like GILTI or subpart F. And they want to change the commentary to allow countries with QDMTTs to effectively give a credit for cross-border taxes like GILTI or subpart F.
So let's talk about each of these proposals separately. First, does a Pillar 2 system, in your opinion, fall apart if U.S. profits are exempt from the UTPR? Does it somehow tilt the playing field to the U.S.?
I don't think so. I don't think exempting U.S. profits from the UTPR would cause Pillar 2 to fall apart. And in fact, I don't think that when people were negotiating the UTPR, anybody thought they were crafting a rule to apply to the U.S. The UTPR is really a backstop rule and is primarily about stopping inversions. If you've got the IIR on your multinationals, the concern is about those multinationals moving somewhere else. I'm not aware of any company that has inverted into the U.S. because of tax reasons. And secondly, if you look at what actually might cause U.S. profits to be undertaxed from a Pillar 2 perspective, the vast majority of it is due to the R&D credit and other non-refundable business credits. And the whole refundable, non-refundable distinction was more a rule of convenience under Pillar 2 rather than being directly tied to the policy goals of Pillar 2. And it seems pretty clear that substance-based credits like the R&D credit ought to be treated just as well as similar refundable credits, because the R&D credit clearly does not undermine the policy goals of Pillar 2. So no, I don't think it tips the playing field toward the U.S.
How about treating GILTI as equivalent to an IR? Do you think GILTI equivalence would create an unlevel playing field for other members of the inclusive framework?
That is one of the major concerns that foreign governments tend to have, but I don't think that it does tilt the playing field toward the U.S. GILTI is plenty burdensome due to the FTC haircut and expensive apportionment. So the effective rate often is above 15%. And I definitely don't see taxpayers lining up to be subject to GILTI.
I don't either. So is there a principled reason that GILTI should go before the QDMTT? It sounds like this proposal would be elective. Is there a reason that some countries might want to allow GILTI to go first?
I can construct a principled policy argument for GILTI to go before QDMTTs, but I don't think that's what's going on here. From a U.S. perspective, this is probably driven by a belief that QDMTTs will reduce the U.S. revenue from GILTI by increasing the FTC's foreign tax credits that taxpayers will be able to claim. And that analysis makes sense, at least in the short term. In the longer term, whether that's true really comes down to what you think about taxpayer response to higher foreign tax rates. And to me, it's really interesting. The range of uncertainty in the JCT analysis of Pillar 2 really highlights that question of what you think taxpayers will do. But in any event, it's pretty clear that Treasury thinks that it's going to reduce U.S. revenue, and that's why they're focused on this question. In addition, as you suggest, there are presumably some countries who might want to allow GILTI to go first. I think there were several countries who didn't really want a QDMTT in the first place. They didn't need the revenue, but they enacted one because they felt like they had to. And so if they can give a credit for GILTI, that could potentially make those jurisdictions more attractive to U.S. multinationals.
So what is the timeline for the U.S. to work with the inclusive framework to achieve these goals?
Well, as we talked about, the UTPR safe harbor expires at the end of this year, so they need to have something in place by then. And that's really ambitious. Assuming that they can get political agreement, and that's still a big assumption at this point, there will definitely be lots of technical questions that need to be answered. And then once they answer those questions, countries need to change their laws, need to enact legislation consistent with that new deal. And if countries don't change their laws by early next year, the UTPR safe harbor expires. So you could see some accrual of UTPR safe harbor with respect to U.S. profits in financial statements if, again, those foreign laws are not changed in time.
So that timeline seems pretty tight. Is there any indication that the members of the inclusive framework will be receptive to working with the United States?
They're mostly still digesting it, as far as we can tell, but we have seen a couple of things that indicate willingness, at least to negotiate at this stage. The inclusive framework statement that came out after the plenary says that discussions around the implementation of Pillar 2 are ongoing, which indicates that all the countries of the inclusive framework think that it's worthwhile to at least keep talking about it. Secondly, we saw a few weeks ago the Polish presidency of the EU suggested three options to EU member states about dealing with the US with respect to Pillar 2 that overlap to some degree with what we understand the US position to be. So there are some indications that countries are willing to negotiate here.
It sounds like in general, the responses to the United States requests have been positive, but have any members of the inclusive framework pushed back?
We understand that several EU member states pushed back against the Polish presidency's suggested options that we just talked about. And they said, as we understand it, two things. First, they, the EU member states, need to understand the US position more, get more detail around it. And secondly, that the negotiations should occur at the inclusive framework. So not necessarily saying we can't accept some of these options, but it needs to be at the inclusive framework and we need to understand really what the US position is. Secondly, as an indication, we saw that German businesses had come out strongly after the German election, suggesting that there should be a pause on Pillar 2. But we understand that the German government coalition agreement says that they're going to move forward with Pillar 2. So there's pushback certainly against the idea of a pause on Pillar 2 or that countries would abandon Pillar 2 at this stage.
So what is the incentive for the OECD, the EU, and other members of the inclusive framework to negotiate with the US on this? The Pillar 2 negotiations seem to be quite one-sided at this point. The U.S. has its list of demands. So what could the international community get out of ceding to these demands?
To me, that's really the key question to understanding how this is going to play out. And we really don't know the answer yet. From a tax negotiator standpoint, there's significant value in multilateral cooperation and in achieving a system in which different rules can coexist without one damaging the others. But as you allude to, do countries think that's enough of a get for what they're giving? And at what point do countries think that they've given so much that it damages the system? And I don't think anyone, including the tax negotiators, have fully figured that out yet. The other thing is that for the moment, the tax negotiations are separate from the trade conflict and larger geopolitical discussion. And I think that's absolutely essential to how things are proceeding. But there's no guarantee that that will continue. Other countries might say, okay, I'll give on this tax issue, but in return, this is what I need on trade or other issues. And if that happens, the resolution could obviously look very different than if the tax negotiators control it.
Thanks, Michael. Any final thoughts to share with our listeners on the future of these proposals?
Well, I would just say that even though there's a lot of uncertainty here, I'm actually pretty optimistic that countries can get to a good resolution. As we discussed, I think there's room for Pillar 2 and the U.S. system to coexist without harming each other. And I hope that's where we land. But there's also obviously still a lot of opportunity for misunderstanding to mess things up. And so I think open communication among the various parties is going to be essential here.
Thank you, Michael, for your insights on the U.S.'s negotiations with the OECD Inclusive Framework. And a special thank you to Casey Caldwell for her help behind the scenes with this episode. We'll continue to monitor the progress made with the Inclusive Framework, as well as the expected draft tax bill from Congress, which could obviously have a significant impact on these discussions. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.